I didn't manage to catch this fight live. I only tracked down a good copy of the full fight earlier on today, as you can see here on Daily Motion. So, Jay Opataya dominates. I'm going to use the word dominates. Meris Breedis over 12 rounds to capture the IBF World Cruiserweight title. Now, full disclosure, I'd never even heard of Jay Opataya prior to this fight being announced. I heard Sauerland, who is Breedis' promoter, talk a bit about Opataya and, you know, a few bits and pieces. I'd never seen him fight before, never really heard of him before the Breedis fight was announced. And so what I saw in the ring was a revelation to me, because Jay Opataya was mightily impressive in there. I thought that he had fantastic foot speed and foot movement, very quick hands, excellent distance control, great combination punching. He didn't often let his hands go in more than two shot combinations, but when he did, it was very impressive. I thought his sharp shooting from long range was excellent. He had upper body movement. He was varying the shots from head to body, because early on in the fight, Breedis was using his feet and some subtle sway backs, upper body movement, to have the Opataya straight left hands down the pipe fall short to the head. So Opataya started shooting him to the body. He was also landing, you know, right hands to the body, hooks upstairs, the uppercut, which hurt Meris Breedis. I think it might have been in the fourth or fifth round, clearly hurt him, busted his nose. And as I said at the start, allowed Opataya to dominate Meris Breedis through the first eight rounds of the fight. Now, sometimes when you're watching a fight live, it can appear to be more dramatic than it actually is, because on second viewing, it doesn't seem quite so dramatic. And remember, I watched this fight after knowing what the result was. So to me, it wasn't dramatic because I already knew what was going to happen. And as I say, to me, Opataya dominates the first eight rounds. The fight only becomes competitive in the final four rounds, where Meris Breedis actually breaks Opataya's jaw, although Opataya's team claim that his jaw was actually broken or fractured on one side in the second round, and that Meris Breedis actually fractured the other side of Opataya's jaw late in the fight. Well, if it was fractured early on, there was no signs of it. He didn't seem distressed. His breathing didn't seem any different. There wasn't any blood coming out of his mouth. So maybe it was a very small fracture, a hairline fracture or something like that early on in the fight. The significant fracture appeared to occur very late in the fight, maybe around the 9th, 10th round, something like that, maybe later than that. And the classic symptoms of a broken jaw were apparent. Opataya's mouth was hanging open. There was this dark blood coming out of his mouth. That is typical of what you see when someone has a broken jaw. So Meris Breedis managed to rally late because Opataya started slowing down a bit. Now, I often talk about young guys fighting a young man's fight. When you're in there against a veteran like Meris Breedis, and Jay Opataya is 27 years of age, so he is 10 years younger than Meris Breedis. When you're in there fighting an older guy, what you don't want to do is allow him to slow the pace down, is play his game, fight his fight. You don't want to do that, because he knows how to negotiate the 12 rounds. He knows how to fiddle his way through a fight, find little moments to rest in the fight, you know, lull you in and hit you with counters. These old veterans know how to do all this stuff, tie you up, all this kind of thing. So what you want to do is use your youth to the full extent, to your absolute advantage. When you're a young man, you've got faster feet than when you're an older man. And Jay Opataya is going to have fast feet regardless, right? Sure, he had fast feet at 20, still got fast feet at 27. Probably when he's 35, his feet will be faster than most cruiserweights, even though probably not as quick as they are now. But use that. Make it a fight where the old man has to try and keep up with you physically, where you're bouncing in and out of range, excellent range control from Opataya, touching Meris Breedis with a jab, looking for the opportunity, put a left hand down the pipe, and make it a high volume fight. And it was a pretty high volume fight through the first eight rounds, where Opataya again, messing with the range, bouncing in and out. Breedis ain't going to be able to keep up with that. Breedis has never been a slow-footed fighter, but he's not a particularly fast-footed fighter either. So again, Opataya was taking advantage of that. And for me, this was the most clear and comprehensive defeat that Meris Breedis has suffered. He'd only previously lost to Oleksandr Usyk, as far as I'm aware. And the Usyk fight was highly competitive. The Usyk fight was genuinely close. This fight wasn't close. I had it exactly the same as two of the judges, 116, 112. And I guess I obviously have to state that this is a much older version of Maris Bredas than the one who Alexander Usyk fought. And if you really want to be extra fair, you could say, well, Maris Bredas, was he really up for this fight as much as he was for the Usyk fight? Had to travel out of Latvia, which he rarely does. He has traveled out of Latvia a few times, but all Maris Bredas' major fights have been in Latvia. He fought Usyk in Latvia. He fought Glavatsky in Latvia. He fought Mike Perez in Latvia. Do you know what I mean? All his major fights tend to be in Latvia where he's comfortable. Whereas for this fight, he had to come out of his comfort zone. Big time difference between Latvia and Australia. So there were lots of things that he had to contend with. But obviously, as a veteran, these things shouldn't bother him that much. You know, his amateur career and his pro career, he's traveled around and he's done things. So it shouldn't bother him that much. And again, I don't want to take anything away from Jay Opataya. I'm just putting all the, you know, the reality of the situation on the table for people who are going to want to say, hey, you didn't mention this, you didn't mention that. Okay, Maris Bredas, maybe not the fighter he was a few years ago, but still a fantastic cruiserweight, still very dangerous. And it was Opataya's brilliance that made him look pedestrian at times. Because not many fighters in the cruiserweight division, if any at this point, since Usyk has moved up, nobody else can move like this. Nobody else I'm aware of. With the constant in and out movement. And on top of the excellent boxing skills that Opataya displayed here, he also showed a tremendous chin. Yeah, jaw broken, but at no point did he look like he was going to get dropped by Maris Bredas' shots, at least not to me. At no point did he seem completely out of it. He was buzzed a couple times, but there was never a time when I thought, okay, he's on the brink of going down here. So he showed a real good chin. Although, after having a broken jaw in this fight, will that affect his punch resistance any? I don't know. I guess we'll have to see moving forward. But in this particular contest, he showed a very good set of whiskers. So all in all, very, very impressed by Jay Opataya. Comprehensively defeats Maris Bredas. No issue with the scoring here. I thought the judges had it bang on. And he already is apparently talking about fighting Lawrence Okolie. His team say they're interested in that unification. Will they really go for that first, or will they instead pivot and go for what I deem to be an easier touch in Makabu? I think that that would be the logical business decision, right? Obviously, as a boxing fan, I want to see him go for the Okolie fight right away. But from a business perspective, it will probably make more sense. Because think about it, Jay Opataya is young. He's 27 years of age. So there's no rush for him to go straight for the most dangerous unification. He can take his time and go for an easier unification against Makabu, and then come to the negotiating table against the Okolie with two belts and say, hey, you got to pay me more. Do you know what I mean? Now, again, as a boxing fan, I don't want to see that happen. I would rather the Okolie fight happen next, because I think based upon recent performances or Opataya's performance here and Okolie's recent performances, that's the two best cruiserweights in the world. So I'd rather see that next. But, you know, I'm not sure what's in the minds of the business people who look after Opataya. Perhaps they'll be thinking about Makabu rather than Okolie. Anyway, let me know what you guys think in the comments below about Opataya's performance. Were you, like me, blown away, dazzled? Because perhaps, again, like me, you'd never seen Opataya fight before. This guy was a real revelation. I know he fought for a long time in the amateurs and had a good career there and what have you. But as a pro, you scroll down and look at Opataya's record, there's really nobody on there. So this came kind of out of the blue in terms of there was no previous form against really high-level opposition to suggest, as a professional, of course, to suggest that Opataya would be able to dominate Maris Bredas like this. It's one thing pulling off an upset and beating a champion, but to dominate him in this fashion. There was nothing in his career up until, the guy that he fought before Bredas was 7-2-2. And Opataya has fought outside of Australia twice. Once in Mexico, very early on in his career, and once in, what was that? Is that the Samoan flag? I'm not sure what flag that is. It might be the Samoan flag. And I believe he's of Samoan heritage. So other than two fights, all of his contests have been in Australia, and this fight itself was in Australia as well. And although you've had some great fighters come out of Australia over the years, as it stands right now, it's not exactly a hotbed of world-class talent. They do have Kambosos, Now they got Upper Tyre, but again, they don't exactly have a hotbed of talent there. So for him to really have nobody on his record, do you know what I mean, in terms of the world scene, and then come in and dominate Marius Bredis like that, it's an eye-opener for me. So hats off to Jay Upper Tyre. There is definitely a new star in the cruiserweight division, a very talented fighter, young-ish at 27 years of age. Hopefully he can fully recover from that jaw injury and go from strength to strength. Hopefully we haven't seen the best of him and we're going to see even better performances than this. Now, in terms of a fight against Lawrence Okoli, it's a very different kind of prospect because Lawrence Okoli at 6'5" would tower over Jay Upper Tyre. Lawrence Okoli has a longer reach than Upper Tyre, although here it says Upper Tyre's reach is 76 inches, which is a nice wingspan. But Lawrence Okoli's reach is even longer than that. And as we saw many years ago in the Isaac Chamberlain fight, Okoli is able, just with his sheer strength and size, to nullify a guy who is slicker than him, who has better footwork than him, who has faster hands than him. You lay his weight on you and bully you in the clinches and make it awkward for you to get to him at range. That's what he did to Isaac Chamberlain, because people looked to Isaac Chamberlain and Lawrence Okoli separately and they said, well, Chamberlain's on another level in terms of slickness and coordination and all this kind of stuff. That's what people were saying. They didn't factor in the physicality of Lawrence Okoli. He's so physically strong and he hits so hard that he can nullify a lot of that stuff in terms of the disadvantages against a guy like Isaac Chamberlain. Could it be the same with Upper Tyre? Now, I think Upper Tyre is better than Chamberlain by quite some way. I think he's got faster feet, better footwork, showed a real good chin here, and obviously tremendous confidence to go in there when he doesn't really have the background as a professional to indicate that he's on that kind of level. He clearly believed in himself. He knew inside, I'm on this level and beyond. So tremendous confidence there too. So yeah, I'm saying this guy's better than Chamberlain, but I'm just using Chamberlain as an example of somebody who looked a lot slicker and more precise and what have you than Lawrence Okoli, but was just bulldozed. Okay, that fight went the 12 rounds, but Isaac Chamberlain was never really in it. With Jay Upper Tyre, surely Lawrence Okoli would be looking to do the same thing, because he's not going to be able to stand there, as in Lawrence Okoli, and go jab for jab and, you know, counter for counter with Upper. He's not going to be able to do all that. He's not as well coordinated. His feet ain't as fast. He's not going to be able to do that. So he's going to have to impose himself physically. Dare I say it, make it an ugly fight. And if there's one thing Lawrence Okoli knows how to do well, is make a fight ugly if he has to. Sometimes even when he doesn't have to, he can make a fight ugly. Will Jay Upper Tyre be able to cope with all that? Will he be able to maybe evade Lawrence Okoli's attempts to come in and clinch and whatever and actually back off and throw counters? Because most orthodox fighters do tend to find it a bit more difficult clinching a southpaw than clinching an orthodox, particularly if the southpaw fights side on. If you're up against the southpaw who's very square, like let's say, I don't know, pick a random name, James Kirtland, a guy who squares up and comes, he kind of gives away his southpaw advantage, right? The advantage being the southpaw is used to facing orthodox fighters because most boxers are orthodox. So he's training his whole amateur career and fighting people in the amateurs and in the pros. He knows how to get past the orthodox fighter's lead hand and land his own right jab. But with orthodox fighters, they struggle to land their jabs against southpaws, most of them, because they don't fight that many southpaws or even spar that many. So when you square up as a southpaw, you're giving away that advantage because now all of a sudden there's an opening there for the orthodox fighter to slot their shots right in between your guard, if you've even got a guard up, you see? So with, southpaws, if the guy's actually staying side on, it can be difficult to grab hold of him. It can be difficult to certainly land your jab, and you're relying really on a straight right hand. Now, Lawrence Okoli does have a fantastic straight right hand. Very powerful, and it's quite fast as well. So Jay Upper Tyre is going to have to watch out for that. I think it's an intriguing fight, and I'll talk more about it if the fight actually gets made. So anyway, long story short, let me know what you guys think in the comments below about Upper Tyre's performance here. How impressed were you? How did you score the fight? Did you, like me, agree with two of the judges, 116, 112? And let me know what you think about the prospect of a unification between Upper Tyre and Lawrence Okoli. How do you see that fight going? Let me know it all. Let me know all of what I just talked about in the comments below. All right. One of the things which frustrates me in boxing is when I see a fighter with a trainer who doesn't quite know how to make the most out of that fighter's talent, but the fighter sticks with the trainer because he's winning. But objective observers who know what they're looking at can see that there are holes in the fighter's game, that there are aspects of the fighter's game that are underdeveloped or completely undeveloped. And that was the case with Anthony Joshua for many years. I was calling for him to leave Rob McCracken long before he lost to Andy Ruiz. Now, when you do this, when you come out and say this fighter or that fighter should sack their trainer and the fighter's winning, they're undefeated, you get a lot of backlash. I certainly got a lot of backlash for that. And AJ is not the only fighter who I said this about over the years, but he's the most recent prominent example. You get a lot of backlash because people are saying, what are you talking about? He's world heavyweight champion. He's done this and he's done that. And they start reeling off all his achievements. That's all well and good. But are you looking at the mistakes he's making in the ring? Are you looking at the great performances, right? But in those great performances, there are mistakes. There are areas of his game that need working on. And fight after fight, I was noticing that those areas are not being worked on, or at least those areas are not improving to the degree that you'd want to see. But he's still managing to get the job done and beat people. And the fanboys want to remain blissfully ignorant. They want to ignore all of the warning signs, all of the danger signs that this fighter isn't developing in certain areas as well as they should be. Ignore all that. It's all about emotion for these people. It's, oh, but Rob's his mentor and Rob's his good friend. And do you know what I mean? They get into the emotional side of it. I detach myself from the emotion of it and just look at bare bones, what's going on here in this fight. You know, obviously, you know, we all get emotionally invested in fights, but I'm talking about once the fight is over, it's all said and done, and I'm analyzing what took place in the ring. I'm not thinking about, oh, well, Rob McCracken's a really good guy and he helped AJ. So I'm not thinking about any of that. I'm thinking about it purely from a logical and professional perspective, just breaking it all down. And when I look at AJ against whoever, Carlos Takam, against Joseph Parker, against Alexander Povetkin, against Klitschko, there are things there that I don't like. There's plenty of things I do like, but there were things there that I didn't like. And I wasn't seeing certain aspects of AJ's game improving in the way that I wanted to. So this is me explaining why I was criticizing Rob McCracken for so long and saying that AJ should leave him. Now, one of the, as I said at the start, frustrating things is that it's usually not until the fighter loses that they turn around and say, oh, maybe I should change the trainer. Why wait until then? Why not change the trainer before that happens? This is the frustrating thing. You may have avoided at least one of those losses if you'd sorted out the trainers. And I'm not talking just about AJ here. I'm talking about every fighter, right? Fighters in general. You may avoid certain losses. You may reach your peak as a fighter quicker if you're with the right trainer, if you make the right decision and pick the right guy earlier on, rather than waiting until you lose. It took AJ losing twice before he got rid of Rob McCracken. Really? I mean, people often talk about Lennox Lewis and how great he would have been. He was already a great fighter, but how much greater he might have been if he'd been with Manny Stewart from the beginning. We can only speculate, right? But he was with John Davenport early on in his career. Then he was with Pepe Correa before he got with Manny Stewart. And again, that came after a bad knockout loss. Why wait for tragedy to strike? Disaster to strike, should I say, before you decide to switch things up? You see, you need to be looking for the issues and the problems during the good times. That's how you stay on point. Do you know what I mean? That's how you avoid disaster, is you looking for the issues during the good times. You don't wait until you're lost. Anyway, I'm longing this out. I say all that to talk about what Anthony Joshua has said here in a recent interview. He said, when you're winning, you don't see you need to make changes. That's disturbing to me. Because even though he was winning, didn't he get hurt early against Alexander Povetkin? Wasn't he getting touched up by Carlos Takam? Do you know what I mean? Why didn't he think that, okay, I need to make changes here? That's disturbing to me. But it's not uncommon for fighters to be this way. And in fact, many times with fighters, I think it's misplaced loyalty. I don't think it's even a case of them not realizing that there's things they need to work on. I think it's just that they have this emotional attachment and they feel guilty about sacking the trainer when they're still on a winning streak. Do you know what I mean? So they're like, oh no, let me not do this. Let me stick with them and maybe they'll get better as a trainer. Maybe I can talk to them and we can work on this, that, and the other. No, you got a short time, you know, amount of time to actually get it right, to make life-changing sums of money and to be the best fighter you can possibly be, to be the best version of yourself as a fighter you could possibly be. A very short window, very small window within which to do that. Don't mess about and, oh, I feel loyal to this trainer and I feel loyal to this. No. They can go train somebody else when your career is finished, yeah? As soon as you sack them, they're off working with somebody else. It's no issue for them. It's you who has a very small window within which to make things happen. They've got a whole lifetime as long as they can stand up being a trainer or being a manager or being a promoter. But don't worry about them. You have to be selfish as a fighter. You have to be selfish. And I'm talking about in your professional life. I don't mean personally because some people, you know, they're a bit dim and they don't realize I'm talking about boxing from a professional standpoint. I don't mean this should apply throughout the rest of your life, you know, in all aspects of your life. I'm talking about in boxing. So anyway, AJ said, when you're winning, you don't see that you need to make changes. Goes on to say that, I think all fighters should experience training with new trainers. I think it's important for growth. Amen to that. I don't think you should ever hold yourself subject to one trainer your whole career. That's just my opinion. And it's not a thing where it's disrespecting anyone. It's about growth. You have to try and experience new things. See what you like from other people if you have the opportunity. That's all it was. It was time for me to grow as a fighter. When you're winning, you don't see that you need to make changes. He goes on to say, well, this is now quoting from Robert Garcia, that a lot of things change in training camps. Once a fighter, well, this is AJ again now. Once a fighter gets too comfortable with his trainer and trainers get too comfortable with fighters, things are going to fail. And that's probably what happened in his last camp. Who's this talking here? Okay, sorry, this is still Garcia. Excuse me. Yeah, once a fighter gets too comfortable, that's probably what happened in his last camp. So now it's a new voice. He shows it in the ring. He shows it in the gym. And he's hungry and motivated to do it. We sit down and watch sparring matches together. And he's writing notes. So he's showing me that he really wants it. When the bell rings, it's going to be him and Usyk. That's it. He's going to have to do what we've trained him to do. We can give him the right instructions, all the instructions in the world. But if he doesn't do it, there's nothing we can do. So far, things are working out. Says, watching the first fight, I was really surprised. I was happy for Usyk because we've trained together, but I didn't expect him to win that fight. Coming to camp, Angel Fernandez has told me many things that went wrong and things that didn't happen, things they didn't do in camp. So that could be a good reason, but now I'm here and we'll do whatever it takes. I'm focused on getting this win. I have many other fights going on with my other fighters in California that I'm going to miss, because I need to be here for the last 8 weeks to focus on getting this win, to prepare him mentally, because I think that's the most important thing. Physically, he's going to be ready. We're training him, we're pushing him. But mentally, I think that's going to be the most important thing. Goes on, he said here, it's definitely affected me in a way where you've got to keep motivation high for a long period of time, but it's helped me in a way where I've had a long time to work with my coaches. Okay, so it's now AJ talking. Long time to work with my coaches and iron things out I don't like in training camp. They're ironing out things they don't like, but it's just keeping that motivation, that consistency, preparing for a fight. That's the only issue I have with the fight being pushed back so long. Okay, well, most people feel that the fight being pushed back benefits Joshua, and I'm certainly in that camp. So the longer it gets pushed back, the better it is for him. Gives him more time to train with Garcia, to gel, and also to get himself right mentally, because that's not an easy thing a lot of the time. Let me know what you guys think in the comments below about what AJ has said here. And for me, teaming up with Garcia is all well and good. But the most important thing from a change in trainer perspective is that there is one voice in the corner. There can't be a bag of people giving different instructions with different ideas. No, there has to be a clear, as we saw, for example, I forgot to mention this in that video, but the fight between Jay Opataya and Myres Breeders. Opetaia's corner did a fantastic job. That's what you want to see a corner do in a championship or any fight for that matter. Jay Opetaia's corner gave clear, concise, logical instructions that were easy for Opetaia to follow. And there was just one voice in that corner. Excellent job they did. I forget the name of his trainer. Is it Mike Wilson? The name of Opetaia's trainer. He did a fantastic job. That's what needs to happen in AJ's corner. There can't be a bunch of people. AJ isn't the kind of fighter. See, most fighters won't respond well when there's multiple voices. But if there are fighters that can respond well to multiple voices, it needs to be like a Mayweather type of fighter, where he knows what he needs to do anyway. He's just taking a few little bits and pieces. Some outside the ring observers were able to give him a few little extra bits of data for him to go in there and do his job. Yeah? A guy like Mayweather, maybe he might be able to still be very, very successful with multiple voices in the corner. But with AJ, no, his IQ is not that high. I'm not saying he's got the worst IQ in boxing IQ in the world. No, but it's not elite level boxing IQ. Therefore, he needs definitely, in my view, one trainer, one clear voice, one clear message. I mean, he said recently that he thought he was winning the fight because he didn't hear any urgency from his corner. So again, this shows you that his awareness of the situation, if indeed what he was saying was true, right? His awareness of the situation isn't as high as it would be with other fighters, certain other fighters who would understand, okay, I'm in trouble here. I need to put my foot on the gas and just attack this guy. All this standing off and jabbing and no. Never mind what the corner's saying. I know what's going on in the ring. So certain fighters would take matters into their own hands. AJ doesn't appear to be one of those guys, okay? So if you are putting AJ in there and you've programmed him to fight a certain way, then there needs to be one voice when it comes to that. You can't confuse him. You got to give him clear, concise instructions. Will that be the case with this new corner team for AJ? I don't know. I certainly hope it's the case for his sake. Let me know what you guys think in the comments below. And do you have any other examples of fighters who should have changed trainers sooner? Now, I don't even know whether it's going to work out with Robert Garcia, but all I know is that he had become stagnant and he'd reached a plateau with Rob McCracken. There were certain aspects of AJ's game that were not being improved and they needed improvement. There were certain weaknesses that were not being addressed and they needed addressing. Whether Rob Garcia is the guy to address them or not remains to be seen, okay? But maybe you guys have got some other examples, maybe recently or longer ago in boxing history, of fighters who should have changed trainers sooner and it would have worked out better for them. Let me know in the comment section below.